This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Irvin Cooper of Los Angeles. He was a naval aviator in World War II and insists he's 92 years old, but he sure doesn't look like it. If you look through the pages of his new book, Peter Bogey Mike, you'll find quite a few photos that'll grab your attention, like the one of the cannon hole in the wing of their PBM. You'll find some of the stories that we've heard on the show today and some we haven't. Pretty entertaining stuff with regard to his wedding to Elaine. They're going to celebrate their 70th anniversary this March. And I think you'll also get a kick out of how he managed to get into USC after the war. That's a good story. Soon you'll be able to find the book on Amazon, but for now, the only way to get Peter Bogey Mike is to write to the P.O. box I'm about to give you. I do have this posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well. The paperback is $14.95. There's also a hardcover edition, and here's that address. Peter Bogey Mike, P.O. Box 3467. That's box 34673, Los Angeles, California. The zip is 90034. You can email me also for more information, paul@hometownheroesradio.com. That's paul@hometownheroesradio.com. Anyway, back to Mr. Cooper now. I mentioned a few things folks can find in your book. Any more stories in there that you'd really like to share now?
Well, probably the most significant one is that if you put about 200 hours on your airplane, when we were at the Okinawa phase, they would send the plane back to Saipan. They'd take the engines out and redo the engine. It took 5 days. So we always had a plane at Saipan being redone, and we would have 5 days of R&R. They had a listed men's club, they had an officer's club, drinking and everything that you'd want to do, and they had beautiful Quonset huts and coral walkways and things like that. They had tennis courts. I saw Bobby Riggs work out there with a group that came over to entertain the troops. So we had a great time, beautiful beaches with cleared, and this was our time for our 5 days. And we landed there, they pulled the plane up off the ramp, I see one of our planes still sitting there. And I quit, what are you doing here? And one of the pilots, named James Bistadeau, the co-pilot, they gave you a physical, and then you were free for the time. He couldn't pass an eye test. So they measured him for glasses, and they took a Navy plane, flew to Midway, and they made up glasses for him. And he was supposed to get it back in time so he'd go back with his crew. So when we all got out, the three pilots and our crew are standing there, and they said, one of you will have to go back with this crew. And Joe Igles was our plane commander, and Amos Crum and I were the two co-pilots. So Amos and I have to flip. So we flip a coin, and I watch it circle around until George Washington's land flat, and his eyes look up at Amos, and he'd called heads. So I had to go back. So I went back with another crew, Otho Edwards was his name, a friend named Bill Holligan. We were both aboard the same ship, so we were very friendly. So I had to give up my flight time. And I went back with them. And as soon as we took off, Otho, who was the plane captain, said, I want you to run the thing. So he wanted to see how skilled I was and how he'd fit in. And after a couple hours, he said, that's great. And we took over from there. So I was accepted. When I got back to our ship, we went out on about two or three missions every other night. And on the fourth night, our crew still hadn't returned. And we're standing on the deck. We have to go down a ladder, get on a launch, and go to our airplane and take off. So we're waiting for the launch to take us off on a night flight. And I'm standing there in my flight suit, and Elaine's picture in my chest, as well as some fishing gear down in my pockets and a knife and a 38 pistol on my hip and all that sort of stuff ready to go. And the launch pulls up, and we're waiting for the crew to come up, and it turns out to be my crew. Hey, and they look great. They're all suntanned and everything else, and they're kidding me, how have you been? And as they climb up, James Bistadeau comes up with his glasses on. And I said to him, hey, James, I think, Jim, you better go with your crew tonight. I don't want to go out with your crew. He said, yeah, but I flew all day and you want me to fly tonight? I said, if I fly with your crew tonight, then I have to fly with my crew tomorrow. And normally I'm really easy on stuff. I don't care. I've never been picky. But I insisted on the thing. I said, I had to fly two times going. You took my R&R, the whole thing. And he knew that. He said, ah, hell. So he threw his duffel bag at me, put it on my bunk. So they climbed down, and all the crew that I was supposed to go with went down. My crew was up. We're all hugging, shaking hands. And as Otho Edwards is the last one down, he puts his thumb up and says, I'll see you when you get back. Okay. We never see them again. And the following morning, we were supposed to go out on a flight, and they came in to tell us, we're changing your flight, that Otho Edwards and another plane from our squadron, a new arrival, had been lost, and we spent the time looking for them. So I came within a minute of being on that flight, and I think that's probably the closest time I really came to not coming back at all. And it isn't until I started to write the book and realize that those guys had been at the bottom of the water off Formosa, which is now Taiwan, for the last 50 years, and have not had the life I've had, had the family, schooling, the education and everything that I've enjoyed. It's been some kind of a little bit tough to think about. It just, the way it goes.
Did you ever find out what had happened? Were they shot down? Was it weather or nobody knows?
The report was they had shot up three trawlers and beached them and shot them up, and then they went looking for it. They think they may have found a submarine. And we had practiced a tactic in Hilo, Hawaii, where there was a submarine and two aircraft. They usually come up and try to shoot at you with a cannon. So one plane would come from one side and one would come from the other, and we would crisscross over the plane. Well, Otho Edwards, the crew that I would have been with, had been on that practice. The other crew was a brand new replacement crew and probably hadn't had the same thing. And my feeling is that they probably hit each other. And it wasn't until almost 2 weeks later they finally found one float. But if two planes hit carrying 500-pound depth charges and they hit and they blow up, I mean, everything is totally obliterated. So it's a little scary.
So that awareness that you have, and I understand that the complex emotions that this brings up for you, and especially writing about it in a book to share it with everyone else. But is that something now that, because you realize that could have been you, that it could have all ended right there, that the life you do have is something that you really can't take for granted?
I've never taken. I really cherished my time and been very fortunate with a wonderful family and great friends and activities. I've worked doing what I've enjoyed doing, which was fun. I was a teacher and I was a builder and an architect, and I've done all of that. It's been great, great pleasure. Unfortunately, I didn't make a lot of money, but I made a lot of friends, so what?
Including one really important one who's still by your side all these years later. I've heard that you might have a few Hollywood stories too, some names we might recognize that you've crossed paths with.
The Hollywood thing is a terrible myth. But you got to realize that when the war broke out, the Army had an Army pre-flight school in Santa Ana, and they had thousands of cadets come here. And there's nothing in Santa Ana at the time, but how far were they from Hollywood? My God. So this city was just mobbed with people coming in from outskirts to see Hollywood. They set up the Hollywood Canteen. They closed off Hollywood Boulevard. They had dancing in the street. They had donuts and actresses coming and doing all sorts of things like that, because this was the wild-eyed thing. So when I go in the Navy and I'm sitting in the pre-flight school and they know I'm from Los Angeles, they said, "You're from Hollywood?" And I said, "Yes." So I immediately became a celebrity just by being from Hollywood, because all these guys are from the Midwest and everything else. "Did you know Henry Fonda?" "Well, I didn't know him very well. I've been to parties with him, and I saw him. He's a very nice guy." Well, the minute I told that to that guy, he became a celebrity, because he went home and wrote to his parents and his girlfriend, "I met this guy," and all. And I carried that all the way through the service.
I know there's something else that I should probably cover with you. You got to come home and see Elaine again and have your family, because the war did end and the atomic bomb was a big part of that. When they dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki, you had a pretty unique perspective on what happened there. Tell me about that.
The war was winding down and we heard about the atomic bomb. Strangely enough, the Japanese military would not give up. They were determined, and they had every man, woman, and child in Japan told them, when the Americans invade, whatever you do, you try to kill somebody. Little kids with sticks, stones, guns, whatever they could have. I was at a place called Ulithi, and I saw 5,000, I'm using the word 5,000 because I don't know how to describe it anymore, of ships of every kind, from battleships, cruisers, to tankers, to ships holding supplies, water, men, and all that ready to invade, a million men ready to invade Japan. And they were just standing by. And the atomic bomb went off, and the Japanese said, "No, we're not going to do it again." So they did the second at atomic bomb, which was at Nagasaki. And I understand the Japanese generals and all still refused. It was Hirohito himself who stepped in and said that enough is enough. But had they invaded, they would have lost, I don't know how many men they would have lost, but they would have lost millions of Japanese people too at the same time. Anyway, the bomb went off and we heard about it, and we were on a patrol. They gave us an assignment to go to, and I don't remember the name, prisoner of war camp, where a group of Australians were all in captive. And they, when I went to the plane, instead of having bombs on it, we were loaded with chocolate, with supplies for toothbrushes, teeth, oh, everything you can imagine, care packages galore, and little parachutes. And when you get over there, I want you to drop this stuff over there. So that was our mission. As we were going along, I think I was flying, and Amos was the navigator at the time. He says, hey, we're only about a half hour from Nagasaki. So we were free, and we flew over and got to Nagasaki. There was two valleys there. Japan is so green and beautiful from the sky. I remember flying along the coast and saying, I gotta bring Elaine back to see this. This is unbelievable. The agriculture from the top of a little mountain down to the bottom was all just immaculately done. And we go over this beautiful valley, and the other side was completely browned out, like you could see streets in there and nothing. It was a concrete building that was sagging in the middle of it. And we flew around that thing. And sitting in the plane, I was holding, as we did, we were holding our crotch, if you'll excuse us, because we heard of this word we'd never heard of before. Irradiation, what is kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, irradiation, what is kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, well, it's the radiation will come. If it hits you, you won't have kids, you won't have any. So here we are flying with our hand over our crotch, our hand on the wheel, and we're tipping around flying. We better get the hell out of here. So, and we took some pictures of it there, and we left Nagasaki. We flew over the Japanese camp. Apparently, the people that ran the camp, the Japanese soldiers or whatever, they just took off and left the prisoners there. And we dropped our supplies, and I have a picture of the prisoners coming out, taking off their shirts or whatever they had, and they wrote thanks on the ground that you can see. So that was quite an event.
I could see how that would stick in your mind. And I imagine the other thing that stuck in your mind was the war ending and you getting to come home and actually seeing Elaine again. Do you remember what that felt like, what that moment was like?
I think every day I was looking forward to seeing Elaine again. And the interesting part about that is we took our planes back. We had a chance to go on into Japan to a Japanese seaplane base there or come home. Had I not been married, I'd have gone into Japan, as most of the younger guys, most of the single guys did, but the married guys said we'd rather go home. So we took a plane back, and we landed back in Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii, and there was a carrier coming that loaded up people to bring home. So he said, well, you'll be in Kaneohe Bay, just relax, swim, go to have fun. The carrier will be in 5 days. You sleep on the deck practically. They had so many people coming back. So I was sitting in a wardroom there, just gossiping. A guy walks in and said, we have a war-weary airplane that we fly back to Hawaii tonight. Anybody want to do it? So I jumped up right away and said, I'd love to. So I ran there, and they verified the fact that I now had my plane commander's first pilot's license and all that. And they said, okay. And a volunteer group also that wanted to get home rather than wait for the carrier and be on the carrier another 5 days to get home, we flew the plane back. So my last flight in the Navy was flying a PBM back, an old war-weary aircraft that they were going to study, with a pickup crew, and going through the whole ritual and flying all night, and suddenly dawn coming up and seeing the Golden Gate Bridge, flying with San Francisco buildings towering off the right wing, and looking at that, and then coming in and making a landing at Alameda. I never realized that would be my last flight. And the last flight was, you know, Peter Bodhi might request permission to land, and we landed the plane, and the book ends with over and out.
I've got a couple more questions for you. I do want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Thank you for writing this book so people understand, and that's a question I have. Why write the book? What was it that spurred you? You said, you know what, I'm going to put this out there so people can know what it was about.
I've always wanted to be a writer, and I was the first editor of the school paper and stuff like that. I wrote several short stories, which George Au, my benefactor, had read, and he loved the stories. Why don't you put them together in a book? So I fortunately had my flight book, and it had every flight that I ever took, and it just followed all the way through.
And there's some good sense of humor in that book.
Sense of humor has always been part of me, sometimes for good and sometimes for bad. You get in trouble too much with it.
Maybe that's the point to segue to what's your secret for almost now a couple months away from 70 years of marriage. A lot of people don't think that's possible anymore. So what's your secret?
As I said before, it's in the genes, I think. And the fact is that we have a great respect. And I think having good kids and having a wonderful family, our family is a mixed family. It's funny, starting out in Boyle Heights in an ethnic group, half of our kids are part Chinese, half of them are Filipino, some of them are Hawaiian, and we have Presbyterian, we have Jewish, we have our whole group of family is mixed, intermixed, and the kids love each other. They contact each other, they call each other, and most of them have stayed in our house at one time or another, and we just have this great family feeling, and I think that does a lot to keep things cohesive. We're very, very fortunate. The reason we got married, of course, if I wanted to go to bed with my girlfriend, the only way I could do it was get married. So I don't know how it works today, but it worked out well for us.
On that note, we are out of time. That is Irvin Cooper, 92 years old, of Los Angeles, California. Pick up that book, Peter, Bogey, Mike, and make sure you tune in again next time when we remind you once again that freedom is not free.